Well, as you hear those lyrics, we are the ones who learn to love the pain. We choose to light the spark. And you catch that part, don't give up hope. Right? There's something in those lyrics that we love, isn't there? Like that deep inside us, we crave that kind of message, that kind of encouragement, that kind of pump up, because we know we're going to face challenges, and I love the idea that I could be the one who overcomes, right? And so as you listen to that, maybe there's a challenge that you've been through. Maybe there's something you're going through right now where you're like, yeah, I need that word. I need that kind of strength. I need that kind of hope. I need that kind of encouragement. Because think about if the lyrics were a little bit different. What if instead the band came out here and Neil grabbed his mic and he started singing, my life is always easy. Everything's going great. My plans are all successful. Think I'll just chill today. You hear a song like that, I mean, it's not like we never rest or we never get to relax, but if I hear that, I'm thinking, oh, good for you. That sounds nice, but it doesn't feel like it matches my real life, right? There are absolutely moments of celebration, moments of rest, but life is full of tension, and life is full of challenges. There are things to overcome. I think that's why deep down inside us, we love a line like, we're the ones who learn to love the pain. That it's not going to slow me down. I actually can get through that. Well, about 2,000 years before that song was written, there's a guy in the Bible named Paul who wrote something very similar. Now, Paul's a guy who's been through a lot of life's challenges. He has faced betrayal from some of his closest friends. He's faced disease. He's been beaten. He's been stoned, which means people throw stones at you until you die. And they literally left him for dead, thinking they had finished him off. He's been shipwrecked. And yet, this is what he writes. It's actually a letter to some of his friends where he's encouraging them how to follow Jesus. He writes, therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake, for when I am weak, then I am strong. And when I was looking at this earlier this week, I'm thinking, I take pleasure in infirmities? But you know, it sounds a lot like the song we were just hearing. I've learned to love the pain. How's that possible? What does that mean? And what does it bring me to? Because at the end he says, when I'm weak, then I am strong. Not sometimes I'm weak and sometimes I'm strong. He says, when I am weak, that's when I'm strong. Those things are in tension. How can those both be true at the same time? Because this is either really inspirational, or maybe Paul's just kind of a sicko, right? So here's what I want you to think about today. Is it possible, as we think about the brains of the operation, what is built into our bodies, that a lot of the evidence I'm looking for about God and the spiritual world out there might actually be in here? Is it possible that there are things about our physical bodies that potentially reveal realities about our spiritual selves? So we're going to look at the muscular system today to pull out a few of those lessons. And the first one is really this, that we build strength through tension. It's actually where our strength comes from. So we're often thinking like, I'm just waiting for life to get a little bit easier if I could get rid of all these tense and difficult things. But like that song, like this letter that Paul is writing, we actually build strength under tension. Now, this is easy for you to picture in the body. Maybe one of the most common examples is going to be the difference between your bicep and your tricep, right? So you know when you contract your bicep, it stretches your tricep. If you contract your tricep, that stretches your bicep, right? Those are called antagonistic muscle pairs. You have them all throughout your body. So when you do something, like if you're lifting weights and you do a curl, your bicep is the agonist, your tricep is the antagonist. What this means, though, is that your arm is never fully relaxed. Something is always in at least a little bit of tension. So when you think about your regular life, isn't that kind of always true? There's always a little something in the background that still needs my attention, still needs my effort, still needs my energy. Your body, even when you rest, even when you relax, my biceps are partly stretched right now. That actually helps us build stability. That's why we can do some of the fine movements that we can do, because there are things that are actually working against each other in tension in your body all the time. So on the macro level, you see an elbow bending. On the microscopic level, what is happening inside your muscle fibers is actually that, in a sense, there are two different kinds of fibers that are hooking onto each other to grip one another to maintain that strength. And then they have to release, and then they hook, and then they release. And so what's kind of cool about this is, to build strength, it actually takes repetition. So the more you do that movement, the more you do that movement under tension, your body literally builds more of those couplings so that you now can maintain that strength even longer. Well, there's one of the greatest leaders in the history of the world was a man named David. He was a guy who had absolutely learned this lesson in his life. Now, David was known as King David at that time, and he's probably the only David in all of history who can just go by David, because he's the one that made that name famous. Like all the Davids that we know today, the name was passed down from this man who lived about 3,000 years ago and about 1,000 years before the time of Jesus. He was a king in Israel. So if you've heard of David, like the one story that's probably most familiar about him is David versus Goliath, when he overcomes this incredible warrior from this other nation. But on the day that David faced Goliath, he actually recounts how, before ever meeting that guy, he had faced off one-on-one with a bear. He had faced off one-on-one with a lion as like a teenager, because David was a shepherd. And so he would be out in the field watching over his sheep, and if a bear or a lion was going to attack, it was his job to protect the sheep. And so it's kind of fun because, you know, when we hear about David and Goliath today, you know, people talk about, well, Goliath was pretty slow and David had a slingshot so he could be from far away. Well, guess what? David's entire army was full of professional slingers and none of them wanted to take on Goliath. And when David shows up, he says, I can do this. And here's why. God was with me against the bear. God was with me when I grabbed a lion by the beard and struck it until it was dead. And God will be with me against Goliath. So he overcomes the bear, he overcomes the lion, he overcomes the giant, and eventually he becomes king. But you realize David does not find out how strong he is sitting on the throne sipping wine. He found out how strong he was through the repetition of those challenging circumstances, learning how to overcome, building up that strength. One of the other really cool things about his story, we actually have a biography of David in the Bible. So in case you didn't know this, the Bible looks like one book, but it's actually 66 different books across history that have been collected together into one place. There's one of them called 1 Samuel that captures a lot of David's life. But there's another one called the Book of Psalms. And Psalms is incorporated from multiple different authors writing songs, writing poems, essentially like journal entries. And a lot of them come from this King David. So I'm just going to show you one of them. It's called Psalm 18, because it's the 18th one in the book. And I'm just going to, the whole thing is good. Like if you Google it later and read the whole thing, you're going to love it. I just want to show you a couple lines where this is what David writes. And it says that he wrote this after overcoming every enemy in his life. He writes, "It is God who arms me with strength and makes my way perfect, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze." Don't you love that picture? Because think about what he's saying. To bend a bow of bronze is essentially, that's impossible. Right, so in a bow and arrow, you're going to use all of your antagonistic muscles in both arms to hold that thing tight, to pull that string back, and to stabilize everything before you release that arrow. And so bows are made out of wood because they need to be strong but flexible. Bronze is not flexible. You see, what David is saying is, even things that seem impossible, God makes possible. God gives me the strength to do. And notice that he gives God the credit. Because we would say, David defeated the bear. David defeated the lion. David defeated Goliath. David was a great king. And David's going to say, all of that is because it is actually God who is making me strong. So I don't know what you think about God or the Bible or David's journal entry here, but if one of the greatest kings, one of the greatest leaders in all of history says, yeah, that was possible because of God, I start to listen. Because as you read through the things that David wrote, he basically says, yeah, all that stuff that went wrong and some of David's stuff goes really wrong. He says, that's when I was trying to do it under my own power. And all this stuff that worked and went right, that's when I was following God's lead and asking for God's help. That's what made me a good, a wise, a capable leader. So you hear those things and you think, you know, am I really supposed to believe that David fought a giant? Am I really supposed to believe that impossible things are possible with God? And if you read through the Bible, there are a lot of impossible things that happen. Should I really believe that Jesus walked on water? So one of the things that helped me in my own spiritual journey, questioning and asking these things, is if God is who he claims to be, wouldn't it be strange if he couldn't do miraculous things? If he couldn't do supernatural things? If God really is who he claims to be, but he had the same limitations as us, you know, who we come to earth and live about 80 years and do the best we can with it, but the universe is a huge place and I'm only about 6 feet tall. I'm tiny in this universe. It actually makes more sense that God could do these kinds of things. But then what does that look like in my daily life? Like, what am I actually talking about here? Because, you know, since the time of Jesus, nobody else has walked on water. Like, apparently that's not one of the things that we're supposed to be asking God for help with, right? So what does it look like? Well, here's an example that might be helpful for you. A friend of mine who lives here in Cincinnati is a financial advisor. And I remember having lunch with him a few years ago, and he was just telling me how stressful that can be. And I thought, well, that's got to be because you're constantly trying to watch the market, make this trade, make that trade, take the profits, how long do you stay in, time in the market is better, timing the market, like all that stuff, right? That stresses me out. I'm the relatively low risk, set it and forget it, you know, kind of guy. He's like, no, that's actually not it. It's actually the people. It's when I'm meeting with a client, because some of them are hands-off. They're like, hey, you're the expert. You know, we'll trust you. Do your thing. But some of them, they get really worked up. They're anxious. What if this happens? What if that happens? They're looking at, you know, the returns they've gotten when they expected this at our annual review, and now they're upset at me. Well, why didn't it do better? As if I control the market, and now they're getting frustrated, and now I'm getting frustrated, and I'm trying not to say anything I don't mean to say, but... And you get home from a long day of meetings like that, and that stress and that frustration starts to rub off on my family. And that's not the dad I want to be. That's not the financial advisor I want to be. Well, he'd been attending the exploring services here at Horizon, and he told me that one of the things I keep hearing, though, is that God wants to help me. That God wants to show me ways in my life that I can grow and get stronger and be more patient and all this stuff. So about 3 months later, we had lunch again, and he told me, hey, it's getting better. Oh, good. Like, is the market better? No, I've been trying that thing. What thing? Praying. All right, tell me about it. So he actually started praying for his clients before going into a meeting with them. Essentially, talking to God about the person he was about to meet with and saying, God, help me to have a good attitude as I'm talking to them. Help me be patient if they get frustrated. And would you just bless their family through the things that I'm trying to help them set up for the future, but also just in general. So he started praying for his clients. He said it totally changed the way that he was thinking about people, communicating with people, what he was able to kind of self-control emotionally. And that was a part of his journey to eventually putting his faith in Christ as the person who leads his life. Because he'd seen the reality of God making him stronger for real life situations like that. I think that's exactly what David had experienced, what he had learned. You know, when he would talk about overcoming the bear and overcoming the lion and ready to face Goliath, it's because he knew that God could give him strength that he didn't have. So what David learned and what my friend learned, I think, is the second thing that our bodies are trying to teach us. We find stability when stretched. When life is pulling you in a bunch of different directions and it feels like it's going to just rip you apart, we actually find stability when stretched. Now again, there's a very common example of this that you know very well, known as the knee-jerk reaction. So if you remember, whenever you go to the doctor and you sit up on that table and you feel like you're 5 years old again because your feet don't reach the floor, right? And you remember when you were 5 years old and you come to the doctor and you sit on the table and he walks over towards you with that little hammer. It's like, Mom, I knew I was getting poked today, but is he going to hit me too? And they hit you right there under the knee and you kick the doctor, right? Well, for the longest time, they thought it's that the tendon that they hit, they thought that it was actually the tendon that was creating that reaction. What they've discovered is it's actually in the muscular system, and it has to do with stretching. So we call it a knee jerk, but the term behind it is actually a stretch flex reaction. So what happens is when you hit that tendon, it causes a very quick stretch in your quadricep. Well, your quadricep sends a message, I'm being stretched. And so that it's not stretched to the point of injury, it gets a message back to contract, to kind of work against that stretching so that you're stretched, but not so far that you're injured. That contraction is what pulls your leg up. At the same time, it sends an instantaneous similar message to the antagonist muscle. So just like your bicep and tricep, your quad and your hammy are antagonists, it tells your hammy, relax. Don't fight the contraction happening on the other side. This is how we're going to prevent injury. Does that make sense? So what's kind of amazing about this is most of the signals that are going through your body come from your brain or go to your brain and then back. So if somebody punches you in the quad, it sends a message to your brain, I think I've been hurt. Your brain sends a message back, I'm in pain, right? Well, for this reaction, that path from your leg to your brain takes too long. So what actually happens is it bypasses the brain completely. What they've discovered is the message from your muscles, there's a fiber in the core of your muscle that goes directly to your spinal cord between the T2 and the T4 and directly back to the muscle without ever checking in with the brain. And simultaneously to the opposite muscle at the same time without ever checking in with your brain. Now, here's why that's important. That's how you get stability when you're stretched, because your body is constantly experiencing major and minor stretches, and that signal allows you to stay stable. So while the knee-jerk reaction is like a test if that system is working, you're actually doing this all the time when you just stand around talking to people. Without your brain even knowing it, you are constantly sending that signal, contract this one, relax that one, contract this one, relax that one, to help you balance. So as I stand here talking to you and I turn my hips and I move my arms and that technically shifts my center of gravity a little bit, I don't have to think about which of these muscle groups all the way up and down my body should I flex so that I don't fall over in front of you. My body will take care of that. My muscular system working together with my nervous system takes care of that. We actually find stability when we are stretched. Now, the guy who figured this out was a man named Charles Scott Sherrington, neurologist and a Nobel laureate who was awarded for the kind of things that he had figured out scientifically. So he's the one that figured out it was actually happening in your muscle fiber, not in the tendon itself. And as he looked closer and closer at the way that the body works, at the things that we see on a macro level and we just know it happens, right? Like if you never explained to me how I'm keeping my balance right now, I wouldn't worry about it because I'm keeping my balance right now, right? But he said the more he dug into it, the further he got into the microscopic layers of this, it created a sense of wonder in him that he thought he hadn't had since he was a child.
And so he actually wrote a book about this because he wanted people to be able to rediscover that wonder. And so here's how he put it. He said, much later, after childhood, when life's pace has slackened, wonder may return, but greatest wonder, our wonder soon lapses. A rainbow every morning, who would pause to look at? The wonderful which comes often or is plentifully about us is soon taken for granted. To recapture now and then childhood's wonder is to secure a driving force for occasional grown-up thoughts. You see, what he's saying is things as amazing as your body that you don't even think about when it's just working, right? You know, you maybe remember this when you were a kid in school, and they're like, have you ever thought about how often you breathe in a minute? How often you blink? Have you ever had to make your heart beat? Like, it's just working. And it's amazing. You know, he's saying we lose the wonder because we get so used to it. And we think, well, that's like children are amazed by everything because they didn't know and they're just so. He's like, hey, we get back to that. The deeper we dig into the science, the most grown-up thought you can have is to let that bring back wonder. And later in that same book, he talks about something that he calls natural religion. You know, this idea that we make science the highest truth. Now remember, he's a neurologist and a Nobel laureate for science. He absolutely believes that truth is coming from science, right? You'd be silly not to. But he said, what happens is, if we make that our greatest good and our highest truth, we've essentially formed a religion of nature, a natural religion. That's where we lose the wonder. He said, what natural religion lacks is a personal deity. Charles Scott Sherrington believed that the sense of wonder at what he saw in the body, the deeper he dug to explain everything that, like, I get to explain it to you in 2 minutes because of men like him, pointed him to the reality of God. That the body is so fine-tuned, so irreducibly complex, that when you start to talk about how we have the strength to overcome challenges, it might not just be that we were born for this, but that we were made for this. And so if you think about the journey that he went on, it's kind of the journey that we might be on ourselves. And so I want you to go back to that line that Paul wrote 2,000 years ago, the one that kind of matched up with our song, because this is the line right before it. This is Paul explaining how he got there. He says that he, referring to Jesus, said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, Paul says, most gladly I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. So Paul says, hey, this is what Jesus told me. It's my strength, not Paul's strength, but Jesus' strength is made perfect in Paul's weakness. Paul had learned through all of those challenges, all the things that he had to overcome, that it wasn't ever really his strength. It was Jesus' strength. Well, so what does that mean? Because you see this phrase, the power of Christ. And I watch movies too, and there's definitely movies I wish I hadn't seen. So this is not like the power of Christ compels you, right? No, what he's saying is it's not magic words. It's not voodoo. It's not like sparkling things and potions and no, the power of Christ resting upon him is the strength that Jesus gives in the challenges that he was facing. When the Bible talks about an unlimited source of love, an unlimited source of peace, an unlimited source of self-control, an unlimited source of joy, and an unlimited source of life. He says, I don't want to go through my life anymore where I'm going to have to face tension and challenges, where I'm going to get to go on adventures. I don't want to do it anymore with my limited resources. So if it's true that when I realize I'm actually pretty weak, for all the incredible things about the human body, we're actually pretty fragile, aren't we? He says, when I realize that, and I realize that Jesus is telling me his strength is made perfect in that moment where I realize. Because then I tap into his strength, his joy, his peace, his life. That's why the first line there says, "My grace is sufficient for you." You know, grace is a word that we hear from time to time, but it essentially just means an unearned gift. Forgiveness is the first grace that God gives us. For all of our regrets, for all the ways I've failed my own standard, let alone God's perfect standard, when I come to him and say, "Oh man, you gotta forgive me," he says, "I forgive you." That's a gift, that's grace. But then it grows from there. Then it is the love, the joy, the peace, the self-control, the strength. Jesus is saying, "My free gifts, you don't have to earn them from me. I will just give them to you when you ask for them." Is sufficient. It's enough. It's just what you need. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul discovered that Jesus, that God, was bigger and better and closer than he had ever imagined. Not just out there somewhere, maybe running the universe, but right here to give me strength. And friends, that's the other message that the body wants to teach us. That is how we power through weakness. And this is probably the one that you may be the most familiar with in terms of how the muscular system works, that we actually have to be weak to get strong. So when you think about your muscles, when you do a workout, that soreness you feel afterwards is because you're actually doing microscopic damage to your muscles, right? Tiny little tears. And it's not enough of a tear to be an injury. Again, it's at the microscopic level. These micro tears in the muscle lead to repair and greater strength because it signals your body, we need healing right here. And it heals that by adding new muscle fiber, or what we would call massive gains, right? You get bigger, you get stronger, only when you get broken down and you get weaker. It sounds like the most impossible thing, but you actually have to get weaker to get stronger. That's how we power through weakness. A buddy of mine I was friends with about 10 years ago. He probably knew that massive gains part of this better than anybody I've ever met. I mean, the guy looks like Mr. Universe, V-shaped torso. We used to joke that his biceps are probably bigger than my thighs, which I know I'm on the skinny side, but that's still impressive. I mean, he was just like the muscle man. And so when I met him, like you see the guy walk in the room and it's like, now this is a strong dude. But at the time that I met him, he had also just been through a really difficult divorce. Had 3 daughters that were either in high school or college age. Communication was difficult with them because communication was difficult with mom, and life was just kind of hurting. He was also a self-made man. He was not only strong physically, he was really strong in his business. Business had been waffling a little bit, but he felt like in the next 6 months, it's kind of going to break through that glass ceiling and kind of hit the next tier. And then COVID hit. And his was one of the businesses that got completely tanked by COVID. So now, the guy that looks like the strongest guy I've ever met is feeling really weak. And he told me, you know, I used to go to church like as a kid, but it's been decades since I thought about God at all. And if I'm honest with you, I think part of that is because to admit that I needed God would be admitting weakness. And if there's one thing I do not do, it's admit weakness. I mean, this guy is doing more reps on 225 than you can imagine. Like, I don't admit weakness. I was afraid it was going to make me weak. Because what if God says I got to do it this way instead of that way? Is it going to mess with my business? Mess with my family, mess with my head. But I tell you what, I'm finally willing to admit it. I do think I need help. And so he started reading his Bible. He started praying. He started asking, God, how am I going to get through this? And honestly, what he found was that there was a God who was closer than he could imagine, who wanted to speak to him, who wanted to teach him. That as he was looking in that book, reading through the Bible, he was seeing things that felt like God had taken them right out of his own life. And he got stronger than I've ever seen him before. And a couple years later, he ended up getting a cancer diagnosis. And I remember thinking when he told me, like, why? Just one more thing for Mike to have to deal with. But if you ask Mike, he would sound a lot like David. Hey, God got me through the bear. God got me through the lion. He's going to get me through this. And even as he went through treatment and his muscles were breaking down, I'll tell you, I have never seen him stronger. See, Mike learned the same thing that David learned, the same thing that Paul learned. And so when you put those two lines of Paul's together, look at how this flows. And Jesus said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Therefore I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." That same message that the muscular system is teaching us, that I actually have to become weak to become strong. That same sense of challenge and strength that, you know what? Then when I face these things, it's not that I love infirmities and I can't wait for the next persecution and I just wish someone would bring some distress into my life. It's when it happens, I get that feeling, like that song that pumps you up. Hey, you know what? Bring it on. I'm going to take pleasure in this moment because I know my strength comes from him. And so he uses really almost the same line as David. You notice he says, "for Christ's sake." What he means is for Christ's credit. That when I make it through this and people ask me how, I'm going to say, like David, like Paul, like Mike, it was Christ. So here's an encouragement for you this week. Don't fear weakness. Rise up and stretch your faith muscles. Don't be afraid if something needs to break you down a little bit to make you stronger. Don't be afraid if God lets you go through a challenge because there's something he wants to build up in you. Don't fear weakness. Rise up and stretch your faith muscles. So here's a couple of ways that might look this week. When you get frustrated by something, you face a challenge, instead of complaining, try asking God for help. Try asking. When you are worried about the future, instead of worrying, try trusting that God has a plan and a purpose. When you have a victory, instead of just adding it to your resume, try telling God thank you and giving him credit. Try asking him for his strength this week. Let's pray that way right now. Jesus, we are thankful. I know it starts with forgiveness. Would you forgive us for the things that we regret and the ways that we fall short? Would you give us your stability in life's tension? Your strength when we feel weak. And we'll give you the credit for it. Amen.